Hello, everyone, and welcome to the National Geographic Society program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. I'll be reading articles that were published by the Geographic Society in February of 2025. I hope you enjoy the program. We'll begin with this article, Can You Get Bird Flu from Eggs? Here are the answers to all your pressing questions. We talked to experts about where the science is on risks to humans and how the virus is messing with the food supply. It's written by Daryl Austin. Bird flu continues to make headlines in the United States, and the longer it lingers, the greater danger it poses to humans. H5N1, the strain of avian influenza A that's currently circulating in the U.S., primarily harms birds, but has infected over 200 mammals since 2022, including dozens of house cats and hundreds of cattle herds. The virus has also contributed to the deaths of tens of millions of chickens, causing egg shortages, skyrocketing prices, and closing poultry markets in at least one state. Reports of another bird flu virus called H5N9 on a duck farm in California, a new H5N1 variant spreading in cattle, and a cat possibly infecting its owner, all add to concerns that a more dangerous and infectious version of the virus might yet evolve. As the number of human cases rise as well, some fear we could even end up with another pandemic on our hands. The more this circulates, and the more human cases that occur, the greater the risk that a virus will emerge that is capable of transmitting efficiently from human to human, says Angela Rasmussen, a virologist at the University of Saskatchewan in Canada. That is what we really need to avoid in order to prevent another pandemic from happening. Here's how serious bird flu actually is, why it's disrupting the food supply, and what can be done to protect your pets and loved ones. How serious is bird flu in humans? The version of the virus that began infecting people in the U.S. last year appears to be significantly less lethal than the version behind past human cases. For the 900-plus human H5N1 cases, most of them across Asia, that were recorded from 2003 to 2023, for instance, more than half proved to be fatal. In the current U.S. outbreak, only one of the 68 confirmed cases ended in death. For the most part, human cases in the United States have been mild, says Peter Haffman, a virologist at the Influenza Research Institute at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Cases may be milder for a few possible reasons. The virus may have become less virulent over the years. Immunity to annual influenza strains may have provided us with some level of protection. And most of the cases of the disease so far in humans have occurred through interactions with infected cattle. And the virus isn't as serious or as deadly in that species. The form of the H5N1 virus infecting cattle is a variant called B3.13, while a variant called D1.1 is behind the outbreaks in wild birds and on poultry farms, and the one human death in the country. This more dangerous variant in birds might also explain why infected house cats are becoming especially ill, since they are more likely to interact with and attack infected birds that fly into the yard. More serious variants could yet pose greater risk to humans, However, as the U.S. Department of Agriculture just announced that D1.1 has been detected in Nevada cows. One dairy worker has already tested positive for the variant as well, and more severe cases could result if it spreads widely in cattle. For now, though, one promising fact remains true. There is still no evidence of human-to-human transmission, says Rasmussen. Can you get bird flu from eggs, meat, or other foods? Also encouraging is that none of the U.S. human cases have been definitively linked to food, so the risk of contaminated food making it to the kitchen table remains low. One reason for this is that the USDA tests all beef that enters the market to ensure that it is not contaminated. In December, the agency began bulk testing milk as well. Cooking meat to recommended temperatures will also kill H5N1 and render it safe for consumption. Pasteurization does the same for milk and eggs. I have no concern about the safety of properly pasteurized milk or cooked meat and eggs, as this virus is not very hardy, and pasteurization and cooking should kill it easily, says Scott Weiss, a pathobiologist and veterinarian at the University of Guelph in Canada. This is why, even though USDA tests have discovered trace amounts of the virus in as much as 25% to 30% of America's milk supply, multiple U.S. Food and Drug Administration safety tests have shown that the virus isn't viable in pasteurized milk and therefore won't cause harm, says Seema Lakdawala, a molecular virologist at Emory University in Atlanta. The same can't be said for unpasteurized milk, however. There are reports of an H5N1 infection in a child in California being associated with consuming raw milk, though that was not diagnostically confirmed, says Benjamin Anderson, an epidemiologist who is leading the Emerging Pathogens Institute Bird Flu Response Team at the University of Florida. Even still, he adds, given what we know about how raw milk can contain very high concentrations of virus, it is likely that drinking contaminated milk would result in possible human infection. Raw or pasteurized pet food poses similar risks. This is why several unpasteurized milk products advertised for pet use have been recalled due to bird flu contamination. And the death of a house cat in Oregon was linked to contaminated raw pet food. How is the virus impacting America's food supply? While food products don't pose an infection risk if processed and cooked properly, the virus is still having a huge impact on farms and grocery stores because of the sheer volume of livestock impacted. Over 900 cattle herds infected, close to 150 million farm and aquatic birds contaminated, and more than 20 million egg-laying chickens killed, plus another 13.2 million chickens culled in an effort to contain the disease. Moreover, after infected flocks have been culled, the farmer or manufacturer needs to then focus on cleaning up and undergoing a USDA biosecurity inspection before they can start restocking, a separate process that can take several months longer, explains Megan Davis, a veterinarian at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. All of this and the fact that even if an infected chicken doesn't die, it will not lay eggs, is why egg shortages are rampant and why prices keep climbing, Lakdawala notes. The U.S. cattle infestation further disrupts milk production and distribution, since most infected dairy cows don't produce milk and even temporarily lose the ability to regain milk production after recovering from the illness, says Hafman. Reinfection may also occur, further extending delays, especially when more mild symptoms go unnoticed. Cows will be protected from some of the worst outcomes of the disease after their initial infection, but not necessarily protected from getting infected again, especially if the timing between the first and second exposure is long, says Richard Webby, a virologist at St. Jude Children's Research Hospital and the director of the World Health Organization Collaborating Center for Studies on the Ecology of Influenza in Animals and Birds. Staying safe based on where things stand today. While the risk of bird flu currently remains low for most people, there are several common sense measures you can take to help prevent the virus from infecting your pet or loved ones. One such measure is buying only pasteurized animal products and cooking meat thoroughly. And if you must drink unpasteurized milk, Anderson recommends boiling it first to reduce infection risk. It's also important for both humans and pets to stay away from dead, sick, or strangely acting animals in the wild, especially birds and cats, says Lakdawala, because the virus can be transmitted through secretions of infected animals. Davis says it's also wise to wear protective equipment such as face shields, masks, coveralls, and gloves if you're one who works closely with dairy cows, poultry, wild birds, or sick animals in farm, zoo, or veterinary settings. Staying up to date on your flu vaccine would also help reduce the severity of a bird flu infection if an individual becomes infected, adds Hafman. Protecting against seasonal flu also reduces broader risks that could harm more people. We want to limit transmission of human flu, since a very concerning situation would be someone having both bird flu and seasonal flu, which could create the chance for a new flu virus to occur that has the ability to transmit between people, says Weiss. This is one reason the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has issued an advisory to increase bird flu testing among people who present at the hospital with flu-like symptoms. Doing so could also help identify subtypes of the virus and reveal where the infections are occurring to make sure human-to-human transmission doesn't start happening without our knowledge. We are still in a situation where the circulating virus is poorly infectious for humans, says Webby, but a single mutation could change that quickly, and people should be educated and aware. That completes the article. The title was, Can You Get Bird Flu from Eggs? Here Are the Answers to All Your Pressing Questions, by Daryl Austin. The second article is titled, Maybe Dogs Didn't Need Us at All to Domesticate Themselves. They may have been drawn to the discarded remains from ancient human meals, and a new model shows tame wolves could have become dogs in as little as 8,000 years. Written by Bethany Brookshire. Who's a good boy? Humans have been asking that question in various languages for thousands of years. We make goo-goo eyes at pretty much any cute creature, take it in, and try to make it love us. But domestication isn't just something we impose on other species. Animals can also adapt to us. Dog domestication has prompted some rough debates. That's spelled R-U-F-F. Were humans bringing in or selecting docile members of ancient wolf packs to be their companions? Or were some of those wolves more tolerant of people, inching closer to human leftovers on their own? One major question in this debate is whether the math checks out. Is there enough time for a wholly new species to emerge from wolves acting as scavengers on human garbage? Could the transition from wolf to dog happen in the time span we think this change occurred? A new set of mathematical models, published February 12th in Proceedings of the Royal Society, Biological Sciences, suggests that the math is indeed plausible. Under the right conditions, wolves could have bred themselves into dogs in around 8,000 years. How humans might have directed evolution. Humans have been living closely with dogs for at least 30,000 years, and there are several hypotheses for what kicked off the transition from haughty, wild wolf to shivering chihuahua. Within the most recent 15,000 years, there is strong evidence that artificial selection is happening throughout human cultures, says Alex Capaldi, a theoretical ecologist at James Madison University in Virginia. In other words, humans were selecting traits for dogs rather than letting evolution run its course. But in the 15,000 before that, no one knows what happened. Humans could have been specifically breeding wolves for tamer traits during that time, perhaps for help with hunting. I don't think it is a likely scenario that ancient hunters would have worked alongside predators who would be, at best, more likely to view them as competitors than partners of any kind, says Catherine Lord, an evolutionary biologist at the University of Massachusetts Chan Medical School in Worcester, who was not involved in the study. Maybe ancient people did what we've always done, picked up an adorable baby critter and took it home. This pup-adopting hypothesis would create an isolated population of tamer wolves that mated with one another, driving rapid artificial selection. The theory of self-domestication. But what if ancient wolves chose the human-centric life? Attracted to garbage, successful scavengers would have been tamer, trading aggression for easy meals. These human-associated wolves would have isolated themselves from other packs, breeding with other tamer wolves and acquiring some wagging tails in the process. This last theory, sometimes called the proto-domestication, self-selection, or scavenger hypothesis, came to Capaldi's attention courtesy of the rebooted Cosmos, a Space-Time Odyssey series, starring Neil deGrasse Tyson. In one episode, the astrophysicist sits by a campfire, tosses an old bone out to a wolf, and effectively describes this hypothesis. Capaldi was surprised. He had always heard that humans had shaped wolves into dogs. I wanted to see what the different sides of the story were, he says. He found a contested field. For the scavenger hypothesis, one major objection was that if wolves were just scavenging and selecting among themselves, surely it would take too long. This is where the mathematical models come in, says David L. Zynga, a mathematical ecologist at the University of Wisconsin in La Crosse. I don't think mathematical models have really shown up in this discussion yet, he says. They aren't real ancient wolves or humans, but as simplifications for the real world. I think that they have a lot to contribute. modeling mating among tame wolves. Capaldi, Elzinga, and their colleagues applied agent-based mathematical models to find out how long it would take for speciation, a new separate doggy species, to occur among a pack of ancient wolf scavengers. They ran models where the tamer wolves mated with other tamer wolves and models where they did not. They also examined how faster speciation could occur if garbage levels stayed constant, a way to describe a small, steady human population, or if they increased, indicating a growing population of humans and their trash. They ran each model for 15,000, quote, years. In the many models, early dogs separated from their ancient wolf brethren 37% of the time. If the scavenging animals preferred other tamer animals as mates, they formed packs of early dogs 74% of time. If the tamer animals mated with others like them, dogs separated from wolves in about 8,000 years, and the change lasted more than 3,400 years, often persisting until the model ran out of, quote, time. The changes happened whether human food was constant or if it increased. But if the tamer wolves mated with wilder wolves, they never became a separate species. Tamer wolves mating with other tamer wolves would probably be an issue of who's nearby, says Bridget Van Holt, an evolutionary biologist at Princeton University who was not involved in the study. But while some might like this self-domestication, Van Holt notes that really the phenomenon of wolves that are more tolerant of people, spending their lives closer to people, and benefiting from such a part of natural selection. She also notes that a handful of genes can give animals hypersocial behaviors, and adding those dogs to the model could give an even better picture of early dogdom. Some have favored that the scavenger hypothesis would be too slow to have worked. This paper provides evidence to the contrary, Lord says. A new clue in an old debate. This doesn't mean that wolves definitely did scavenge themselves into dogs, but it does prove a piece of evidence in support of the scavenger hypothesis, Lord notes. Other objections still remain, notes Miette G. Germanopre, a paleontologist at the Royal Belgium Institute of Natural Sciences in Brussels. Archaeological evidence suggests that during the Upper Paleolithic, modern humans deterred large carnivores from accessing their habitation sites in order to protect their stored food and refuse, she says. So even though wolves had plenty of time to form human-associated packs, early humans might have shooed them away. The results also don't mean that scavenging was the only way, notes Capaldi. Humans probably played a role, but the dogs did too. There are lots of processes that are going on, he says. It's probably a question of not which one was it, but which one was the larger factor. But the results emphasize that domestication isn't just something that humans impose on other organisms. It's a two-way street, where both species bring themselves closer together, the beginning of a new best friendship. And that completes the article. The title was, Maybe Dogs Didn't Need Us at All to domesticate themselves. And it's written by Bethany Brookshire. That completes the broadcast for today. This has been the National Geographic Society program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. It's been my privilege to be your Sun Sounds volunteer reader today. The articles I've been reading were published by the Geographic Society in February of 2025. I hope you enjoyed the program, and I hope you found it informative. Keep listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona with its premium programming offered on a 24/7 basis. And if you missed a program you'd like to hear, go to the sunsounds.org website. Then click on Broadcast Info and Audio. On the next page, click on Demand Podcasts. Then you'll see a list of articles available to you. Hopefully the one you're looking for is in that list. Thank you so much for spending your time with me today.